His dreams were fitful. Thibben kept imagining that he was trying to speak, but his voice would not shape the sentences. A nightmare possibility to one whose great-grandfather spoke only crudely with the aid of devices, and whose slightly more distant ancestors faced the world without words at all. Thibben sweated. No shame was greater than this. In his dream he sought speech as if it were an object, a thing that might be misplaced somehow. On looking down, he saw a glittering gem lying on the ground. Perhaps this was the gift of words, Thibben thought, and he bent over to take it. But he was too clumsy. His thumb refused to work with his forefinger, and he wasn't able to pluck the bauble out of the dust. In fact, all of his efforts seemed only to push it in deeper. Despairing, finally, he was forced to crouch down and pick it up with his lips. It burned. In his dream, he cried out as a terrible searing poured down his throat like liquid fire. And yet, he recognized that this was one of those strange nightmares, the kind in which one could be both objective and terrified at the same time. As one dream self writhed in agony, another part of Thibben witnessed it in a state of interested detachment. All at once the scene shifted. Thibben found himself standing in the midst of a gathering of bearded men in black coats and floppy hats. They were mostly elderly, and they leafed through dusty texts as they argued with each other. An old-time Talmudic conclave, he recognized suddenly, like those he had read about in comparative religions class back at the university. The rabbis sat in a circle, discussing symbolism and biblical interpretation. One lifted an aged hand to point at Thibben.
"He that lappeth like an animal, Gideon, he shall thou not take."
"Is that what it means?" Thibben asked.
The pain was gone. Now he was more bemused than fearful. His pal Simon had been Jewish. No doubt that explained part of this crazy symbolism. What was going on here was obvious. These learned men, these wise human scholars, were trying to illuminate that frightening first part of his dream for him.
"No, no," a second sage countered. "The symbols relate to the trial of the infant Moses. An angel, you'll recall, guided his hand to the glowing coals rather than the shining jewels, and his mouth was burned."
"But I don't see what that tells me," Thibben protested.
The oldest rabbi raised his hand, and the others all went silent.
"The dream stands for none of those things. The symbolism should be obvious," he said. "It comes from the oldest book."
The sage's bushy eyebrows knotted with concern.
"And Adam, too, ate from the fruit of the tree of knowledge."
"Ah!"
Thibben groaned aloud, awakening in a sweat. The gritty, smelly capsule was all around him again, and yet the vividness of the dream lingered, making him wonder for a moment which was real after all. Finally, he shrugged it off.
"Old Proconsul must have drifted through the wake of some E.T. probability mine while I slept. Yeah, that must be it. I'll never doubt the stories they tell in a spacer's bar again."
When he checked his battered instruments, Thibben found that the battle had moved on around the sun. His own derelict, meanwhile, was on a nearly perfect intersect orbit with a planet.
"Hmph,"
he grunted as he worked the computer. What it told him was ironic. It really is Garth. He still had a little maneuvering power in the gravity systems, perhaps enough, just maybe, to get him within escape pod range. And wonder of wonders, if his ephemerides were right, he might even be able to reach the western sea area, a bit east of Port Helena. Bibbin whistled tunelessly for a few minutes. He wondered what the chances were that this should happen. A million to one? Probably more like a trillion. Or was the universe just suckering him with a bit of hope before the next whammy? Either way, he decided, there was some solace in thinking that under all these stars, someone out there was still thinking of him personally. He got out his toolkit and set to work, making the necessary repairs. Chapter 9. Uthacalding. Uthacalding knew it was unwise to wait much longer. Still, he remained with the librarians, watching them try to coax forth one more valuable detail before it was time at last to go. He regarded the human and neo-chimpanzee technicians as they hurried about under the high-domed ceiling of the planetary branch library. They all had jobs to do and concentrated on them intently, efficiently, and yet one could sense a ferment just below the surface, one of barely suppressed fear. Unbidden, rittities formed in the low sparking of his corona. The glyph was one commonly used by Timbrimi parents to calm frightened children. "They can't detect you," Uthacalding told rittities, and yet it obstinately hovered, trying to soothe young ones in distress. Anyway, these people aren't children. Humans have only known of the great library for 2 Earth centuries, but they had thousands of years of their own history before that. They may still lack galactic polish and sophistication, but that deficit has sometimes been an advantage to them. Rarely. Rittities was dubious. Uthacalding ended the argument by drawing the uncertain glyph back where it belonged, into his own well of being. Under the vaulted stone ceiling towered a 5-meter gray monolith, embossed with a rayed spiral sigil, symbol of the great library for 3 billion years. Nearby, data loggers filled crystalline memory cubes. Printers hummed and spat bound reports, which were quickly annotated and carted away. This library station, a Class K outlet, was a small one indeed. It contained only the equivalent of 1,000 times all the books humans had written before contact, a pittance compared with the full branch library on Earth, or Sector General on Tanith. Still, when Garth was taken, this room too would fall to the invader. Traditionally, that should make no difference. The library was supposed to remain open to all, even parties fighting over the territory it stood upon. In times like these, however, it was unwise to count on such niceties. The colonial resistance forces planned to carry off what they could, in hopes of using the information somehow later. A pittance of a pittance. Of course, it had been his suggestion that they do this, but Uthacalding was frankly amazed that the humans had gone along with the idea so vigorously. After all, why bother? What could such a small smattering of information accomplish? This raid on the planetary library served his purposes, but it also reinforced his opinion of Earth people. They just never gave up. It was yet another reason he found the creatures delightful. The hidden reason for this chaos, his own private jest, had called for the dumping and misplacing of a few specific megafiles, easily overlooked in all of this confusion. In fact, nobody appeared to have noticed when he briefly attached his own input-output cube to the massive library, waited a few seconds, then pocketed the little sabotage device again. Done. Now there was little to do but watch the wolflings while he waited for his car. Off in the distance, a wailing tone began to rise and fall. It was the keening of the spaceport siren across the bay. as another crippled refugee from the route in space came in for an emergency landing. They had heard that sound all too infrequently. Everyone already knew that there had been few survivors. Mostly the traffic consisted of departing aircraft. Many mainlanders had already taken flight to the chain of islands in the Western Sea, where the vast majority of the Earthling population still made its home. The government was preparing its own evacuation. When the sirens moaned, every man and chim looked up briefly. Momentarily, the workers broadcast a complex fugue of anxiety that Uther Kalving could almost taste with his corona.
Almost taste? Oh, what lovely surprising things, these metaphors, Uther Kalving thought. Can one taste with one's corona? Or touch with one's eyes? Anglic is so silly, yet so delightfully thought-provoking. And do not dolphins actually see with their ears? Zunor Thuzen
formed above his waving tendrils, resonating with the fear of the men and chims. Yes, we all hope to live, for we have so very much left to do, or taste, or see, or ken. Uther Kalving wished diplomacy did not require that Timbrimi choose their dullest types as envoys. He had been selected as an ambassador because, among other qualities, he was boring, at least from the point of view of those back home. And poor Athaclena seemed to be even worse off, so sober and serious. He freely admitted that it was partly his own fault. That was one reason he had brought along his own father's large collection of pre-contact Earthling comic recordings. The Three Stooges, especially, inspired him. Alas, as yet Athaclena seemed unable to understand the subtle, ironic brilliance of those ancient Terran comedic geniuses. Fru Sylph, that courier of the dead but remembered, his long-dead wife still chided him, reaching out from beyond life to say that their daughter should be home, where her lively peers might yet draw her out from her isolation. Perhaps, he thought. But Mathecluana had had her try. Uther Kalving believed in his own prescription for their odd daughter. A small uniformed neo-chimpanzee female, a Chimmy, stepped in front of Uther Kalving and bowed, her hands folded respectfully in front of her.
"Yes, miss?"
Uther Kalving spoke first, as protocol demanded. Although he was a patron speaking to a client, he generously included the polite, archaic honorific.
"Your Excellency?"
The Chimmy's scratchy voice trembled slightly. Probably this was the first time she had ever spoken to a non-Terran.
"Your Excellency, Planetary Coordinator On Eagle has sent word that the preparations have been completed. The fires are about to be set. She asks if you would like to witness your, program unleashed."
As Uther Kalving's eyes separated wider in amusement, the wrinkled fur between his brows flattening momentarily. His program hardly deserved the name. It might better be called a devious practical joke on the invaders. A long shot, at best. Not even Megan Oneagle knew what he was really up to. That necessity was a pity, of course, for even if it failed, as was likely, it would still be worthy of a chuckle or two. A laugh might help his friend through the dark times ahead of her.
"Thank you, Corporal," he nodded. "Please lead the way."
As he followed the little client, Uther Kalving felt a faint sense of regret at leaving so much undone. A good joke required much preparation, and there was just not enough time.
If only I had a decent sense of humor.
Ah, well, where subtlety fails us, we must simply make do with cream pies.
2 hours later, he was on his way back to town from Government House. The meeting had been brief, with battle fleets approaching orbit and landings expected soon. Megan On Eagle had already moved most of the government and her few remaining forces to safer ground. Utha Calling figured they actually had a little more time. There would be no landing until the invaders had broadcast their manifesto. The rules of the Institute for Civilized Warfare required it. Of course, with the five galaxies in turmoil, many star-faring clans were playing fast and loose with tradition right now. But in this case, observing the proprieties would cost the enemy nothing. They had already won. Now it was only a matter of occupying the territory. Besides, the battle in space had showed one thing. It was clear now the enemy were Gubru. The humans and Chims of this planet were not in for a pleasant time. The Gubru clan had been among the worst of Earth's tormentors since contact. Nonetheless, the avian galactics were sticklers for rules, by their own interpretation of them, at least. Megan had been disappointed when he turned down her offer of transportation to Sanctuary. But Utha Calding had his own ship. Anyway, he still had business to take care of here in town. He bid farewell to the coordinator, with a promise to see her soon. Soon was such a wonderfully ambiguous word. One of many reasons he treasured Anglic was the wolfling tongue's marvelous untidiness. By moonlight, Port Helenia felt even smaller and more forlorn than the tiny, threatened village it was by day. Winter might be mostly over, but a stiff breeze still blew from the east, sending leaves tumbling across the nearly empty streets as his driver took him back toward his chancery compound. The wind carried a moist odor, and Utha Calding imagined he could smell the mountains where his daughter and Megan's son had gone for refuge. It was a decision that had not won the parents much thanks. His car had to pass by the branch library again on its way to the Timbrimi Embassy. The driver had to slow to go around another vehicle. Because of this, Utha Calding was treated to a rare sight. A high-caste Thenanin in full fury under the streetlights. "Please stop here," he said suddenly. In front of the stone library building, a large floater craft hummed quietly. Light poured out of its raised cupola, creating a dark bouquet of shadows on the broad steps. Five clearly were cast by neo-chimpanzees, their long arms exaggerated in the stretched silhouettes. Two even longer penumbral shadows swept away from slender figures standing close to the floater. A pair of stoic, disciplined yinin, looking like tall armored kangaroos, stood unmoving as if molded out of stone. Their employer and patron, owner of the largest silhouette, towered above the little Terrans. Blocky and powerful, the creature's wedge-like shoulders seemed to merge right into its bullet-shaped head. The latter was topped by a high, rippling crest, like that of a helmeted Greek warrior. As Utha Calding stepped out of his own car, he heard a loud voice, rich in guttural sibilance.
"Nathakul glumph! Vereitschich human vleck? Nitaro kangli!"
The chimpanzees shook their heads, confused and clearly intimidated. Obviously none of them spoke Galactic Six. Still, when the huge Thenanin started forward, the little Earthlings moved to interpose themselves, bowing low, but adamant in their refusal to let him pass. This only served to make the speaker angrier.
"Idates, Nitaril Kulunta,
The large galactic stopped abruptly on seeing Utha Calding. His leathery beak-like mouth remained closed as he switched to Galactic 7, speaking through his breathing slits.
Ah, Utha Calding, ab Kaltmur, ab Brima, ab Kralnith, ul Titel. I see you.
Utha Calding would have recognized Kalt in a city choked with Thenanin. The big pompous high-caste male knew that protocol did not require use of full species names in casual encounters. But now Utha Calding had no choice. He had to reply in kind.
Kalt, ab Wortel, ab Kosh, ab Rosh, ab Toothtoon, ul Paimon, ul Ramen, ul Yinin, ul Olamin. I see you as well.
Each ab in the lengthy patronymic told of one of the patron races from which the Thenanin clan was descended, back to the eldest still living. Ul preceded the name of each client species the Thenanin had themselves uplifted to starfaring sentience. Kalt's people had been very busy the last mega-year or so. They bragged incessantly of their long species name. The Thenanin were idiots.
Utha Calding, you are adept in that garbage tongue the Earthlings use. Please explain to these ignorant, half-uplifted creatures that I wish to pass. I have need to use the branch library, and if they do not stand aside, I shall be forced to have their masters chastise them.
Utha Calding shrugged the standard gesture of regretful inability to comply.
They are only doing their jobs, Envoy Kalt. When the library is fully occupied with matters of planetary defense, it is briefly allowable to restrict access solely to the lease owners.
Kalt stared unblinkingly at Utha Calding. His breathing slits puffed.
Abes,
he muttered softly, in an obscure dialect of Galactic 12, unaware, perhaps, that Utha Calding understood.
Infants, ruled by unruly children, tutored by juvenile delinquents.
Utha Calding's eyes separated, and his tendrils pulsed with irony. They crafted Psu Usturuatu, which sympathizes while laughing.
Damn good thing Thenanin have a rock sensitivity to empathy.
Utha Calding thought in Anglic as he hurriedly erased the glyph. Of the galactic clans involved in the current spate of fanaticism, the Thenanin were less repulsive than most. Some of them actually believed they were acting in the best interests of those they conquered. It was apparent whom Kalt meant when he spoke of delinquents leading the clan of Earth astray. Utha Calding was far from offended.
"These infants fly starships, Kalt,"
he answered in the same dialect, to the Thenanin's obvious surprise.
"The neo-chimpanzees may be the finest clients to appear in half a mega-year, with the possible exception of their cousins, the neo-dolphins. Shall we not respect their earnest desire to do their duty?"
Kalt's crest went rigid at the mention of the other Earthling client race.
"My Timbrimi friend, did you mean to imply that you have heard more about the dolphin ship? Have they been found?"
Utha Calding felt a little guilty for toying with Kalt. All considered, he was not a bad sort. He came from a minority political faction among the Thenanin, which had a few times even spoken for peace with the Timbrimi. Nevertheless, Utha Calding had reasons for wanting to pique his fellow diplomat's interest, and he had prepared for an encounter like this.
Perhaps I have said more than I should. Please think nothing more of it. Now I am saddened to say that I really must be going. I am late for a meeting. I wish you good fortune and survival in the days ahead, Colt.
He bowed in the casual fashion of one patron to another, and turned to go. But within, Uther Calling was laughing. For he knew the real reason Colt was here at the library. The Thenanin could only have come looking for him.
"Wait!"
Colt called out in Anglic. Uther Calling looked back.
"Yes, respected colleague?"
"I..." Colt dropped back into Gal 7. "I must speak with you regarding the evacuation. You may have heard my ship is in disrepair. I am at the moment bereft of transport." The Thenanin's crest fluttered in discomfort. Protocol and diplomatic standing were one thing, but the fellow obviously would rather not be in town when the Gubru landed. "I must ask, therefore, will there be some opportunity to discuss the possibility of mutual aid?" The big creature said it in a rush. Uther Calling pretended to ponder the idea seriously. After all, his species and cults were officially at war right now. He nodded at last.
"Be at my compound about midnight tomorrow night. No later than a miktar thereafter, mind you. And please bring only a minimum of baggage. My boat is small. With that understood, I gladly offer you a ride to Sanctuary."
He turned to his neo-chimp driver.
"That would only be courteous and proper, would it not, Corporal?"
The poor chimmy blinked up at Uther Calling in confusion. She had been selected for this duty because she knew Gal 7, but that was a far cry from penetrating the arcana that was going on here.
"Yes, sir. It seems like the kind thing to do."
Uther Calling nodded and smiled at Colt.
"There you are, my dear colleague. Not merely correct, but kind. It is well when we elders learn from such wise precociousness and add that quality to our own actions, is it not?"
For the first time, he saw the Thenanin blink. Turmoil radiated from the creature. At last, though, relief won out over suspicion that he was being played for the fool. Colt bowed to Uther Calling. And then, because Uther Calling had included her in the conversation, he added a brief, shallow nod to the little chimmy.
"For my clients and myself, I thank you,"
he said awkwardly in Anglic. Colt snapped his elbow spikes, and his Yinin clients followed him as he lumbered into the floater. The closing cupola cut off the sharp dome light at last. The chims from the library looked at Uther Calving gratefully. The floater rose on its gravity cushion and moved off rapidly. Uther Calving's driver held the door of his own wheel car for him, but he stretched his arms and inhaled deeply.
"I am thinking that it might be a nice idea to go for a walk," he told her. "The embassy is only a short distance from here. Why don't you take a few hours off, Corporal, and spend some time with your family and friends?"
But, sir..."
"I will be all right," he said firmly.
He bowed and felt her rush of innocent joy at the simple courtesy. She bowed deeply in return.
"Delightful creatures,"
Uther Calling thought, as he watched the car drive off.
"I have met a few neo-chimpanzees who even seem to have the glimmerings of a true sense of humor. I do hope the species survives."
He started walking. Soon he had left the clamor of the library behind him and passed into a residential neighborhood. The breeze had left the night air clear, and the city's soft lights did not drive away the flickering stars. At this time, the galactic rim was a ragged spill of diamonds across the sky. There were no traces to be seen of the battle in space. It had been too small a skirmish to leave much visible residue. All around Uther Calling were sounds that told of the difference of this evening. There were distant sirens and the growl of aircraft passing overhead. On nearly every block he heard someone crying. Voices, human or chim, shouting or murmuring in frustration and fear. On the fluttering level of empathy, waves beat up against one another in a froth of emotion. His corona could not deflect the inhabitants' dread as they awaited morning. Uther Calling did not try to keep it out as he strolled up dimly lit streets lined with decorative trees. He dipped his tendrils into the churning emotional flux and drew forth above him a strange new glyph. It floated, nameless and terrible, time's ageless threat made momentarily palpable. Uther Calling smiled an ancient, special kind of smile. And at that moment, nobody, not even in the darkness, could possibly have mistaken him for a human being.
"There are many paths," he thought,
again savoring the open, undisciplined nuances of Anglic. He left the thing he had made to hang in the air, dissolving slowly behind him, as he walked under the slowly wheeling pattern of the stars. Chapter 10 Robert. Robert awoke 2 hours before dawn. There was a period of disorientation as the strange feelings and images of sleep slowly dissipated. He rubbed his eyes, trying to clear his head of muzzy, clouded confusion. He had been running, he recalled. Running as one does sometimes, but only in dreams, in long, floating steps that reach for leagues and seem barely to touch down. Around him had shifted and drifted vague shapes, mysteries, and half-born images that slipped out of reach even as his waking mind tried to recall them. Robert looked over at Athaclena, lying nearby in her own sleeping bag. Her brown timbrimmy ruff, that tapered helm of soft brown fur, was puffed out. The silvery tendrils of her corona waved delicately, as if probing and grappling with something invisible in the space overhead. She sighed and spoke very low, a few short phrases in the rapid, highly syllabic timbrimmy dialect of Galactic 7. Perhaps that explained his own strange dreams, Robert realized. He must have been picking up traces of hers. Watching the waving tendrils, he blinked. For just a moment, it had seemed as if something was there, floating in the air just above the sleeping alien girl. It had been like... Robert frowned, shaking his head. It hadn't been like anything at all. The very act of trying to compare it to something else seemed to drive the thing away, even as he thought about it. Athaclena sighed and turned over. Her corona settled down. There were no more half-glimmers in the dimness. Robert slid out of his bag and fumbled for his boots before standing. He felt his way around the towering spine stone beneath which they had made camp. There was barely enough starlight to find a path among the strange monoliths. He came to a promontory looking over toward the westward mountain chain and the northern plains to his right. Below this ridgetop vantage point, there lay a gently rippling sea of dark woods. The trees filled the air with a damp, heavy aroma. Resting his back against a spine stone, he sat down on the ground to try to think. If only the adventure were all there was to this trip. An idyllic interlude in the mountains of Mulan, in the company of an alien beauty. But there was no forgetting, no escaping the guilty sureness that he should not be here. He really ought to be with his classmates, with his militia unit, facing the troubles alongside them. That was not to be, however. Once again, his mother's career had interfered with his own life. It was not the first time Robert had wished he were not the son of a politician. He watched the stars, sparkling in bright strokes that followed the meeting of two galactic spiral arms. Perhaps if I had known more adversity in my life, I might be better prepared for what's to come, better able to accept disappointment. It wasn't just that he was the son of the planetary coordinator, with all of the advantages that came with status. It went beyond that. All through childhood, he had noticed that where other boys had stumbled and suffered growing pains, he had always somehow had the knack of moving gracefully. Where most had groped their way in awkwardness and embarrassment toward adolescence and sexuality, he had slipped into pleasure and popularity with all the comfort and ease of putting on an old shoe. His mother and his starfarer father, whenever Sam Tennant's sojourned on Garth, had always emphasized that he should watch the interactions of his peers, not simply let things happen and accept them as inevitable. And indeed, he began to see how in every age group there were a few like him, for whom growing up was easier somehow. They stepped lightly through the morass of adolescence while everyone else slogged, overjoyed to find an occasional patch of solid ground. And it seemed many of those lucky ones accepted their happy fate as if it were some sign of divine election. The same was true of the most popular girls. They had no empathy, no compassion for more normal kids. In Robert's case, he had never sought a reputation as a playboy, but one had come over time, almost against his will. In his heart, a secret fear had started to grow, a superstition that he had confided in nobody. Did the universe balance all things? Did it take away to compensate for whatever it gave? The cult of Ifni was supposed to be a starfarer's joke, and yet sometimes things seemed so contrived. It was silly to suppose that trials only hardened men, automatically making them wise. He knew many who were stupid, arrogant, and mean, in spite of having suffered. Still, like many humans, he sometimes envied the handsome, flexible, self-sufficient Tim Brimmy, a young race by galactic standards. They were nevertheless old and galaxy-wise compared with mankind. Humanity had discovered sanity, peace, and a science of mind only a generation before contact. There were still plenty of kinks to be worked out of Terrigan society. The Tim Brimmy, in comparison, seemed to know themselves so well. Is that the basic reason why I am attracted to Athoclena? Symbolically, she is the elder, the more knowledgeable one. It gives me an opportunity to be awkward and stumble and enjoy the role. It was all so confusing, and Robert wasn't even certain of his own feelings. He was having fun up here in the mountains with Athoclena, and that made him ashamed. He resented his mother bitterly for sending him, and felt guilty about that as well. Oh, if only I'd been allowed to fight! Combat, at least, was straightforward and easy to understand. It was ancient, honorable, simple. Robert looked up quickly. There among the stars, a pinpoint had flared up to momentary brilliance. As he watched, two more sudden brightnesses burst forth, then another. Sharp, glowing sparks lasted long enough for him to note their positions. The pattern was too regular to be an accident. 20-degree intervals above the equator, from the Sphinx all the way across to the Batman, where the red planet Tluna shone in the middle of the ancient hero's belt. So it has come. The destruction of the synchronous satellite network had been expected, but it was startling, actually, to witness it. Of course, this meant actual landings would not be long delayed. Robert felt a heaviness and hoped that not too many of his human and chim friends had died. I never found out if I had what it takes when things really counted. Now maybe I never will. He was resolved about one thing. He would do the job he had been assigned, escorting a non-combatant alien into the mountains and supposed safety. There was one duty he had to perform tonight, while Athoclena slept. As silently as he could, Robert returned to their backpacks. He pulled the radio set from his lower left pouch and began disassembling it in the dark. He was halfway finished when another sudden brightening made him look up at the eastern sky. A bolide streaked flame across the glittering starfield, leaving glowing embers in its wake. Something was entering fast, burning as it penetrated the atmosphere. The debris of war. Robert stood up and watched the man-made meteor lay a fiery trail across the sky. It disappeared behind a range of hills not more than 20 kilometers away, perhaps much closer. "God keep you," he whispered to the warriors whose ship it must have been. He had no fear of blessing his enemies, for it was clear which side needed help tonight, and would for a long time to come. Chapter 11 Galactics. The suzerain of propriety moved about the bridge of the flagship in short skips and hops, enjoying the pleasure of pacing, while Gubru and Quacku soldiery ducked out of the way. It might be a long time before the Gubru high priest would enjoy such freedom of movement again. After the occupation force landed, the suzerain would not be able to set foot on the ground for many miktars. Not until propriety was assured and consolidation complete could it touch the soil of the planet that lay just ahead of the advancing armada. The other two leaders of the invasion force, the suzerain of Beam and Talon, and the suzerain of Cost and Caution, did not have to operate under such restrictions. That was all right. The military and the bureaucracy had their own functions. But to the suzerain of propriety was given the task of overseeing appropriateness of behavior for the Gubru expedition. And to do that, the priest would have to remain perched. Far across the command bridge, the suzerain of Cost and Caution could be heard complaining. There had been unexpected losses in the furious little fight the humans had put up. Every ship put out of commission hurt the Gubru cause in these dangerous times. Foolish, short-sighted carping, the suzerain of propriety thought. The physical damage done by the humans' resistance had been far less significant than the ethical and legal harm. Because the brief fight had been so sharp and effective, it could not simply be ignored. It would have to be credited.